Thank you, Corina, Steve, for inviting me here. First, a few pictures motivating this research. This is what I this tape comes from Montreal Neurological Institute back a few years ago when I used to work at McGill, and I was told that what's really missing, what was missing at that time and seems still to be missing, is understanding of brain trauma from the point of view of geometry, anatomy, and mechanics. Here we go, sloshing in cadaver brains and so on. Now, this is real. This is not real. This is speculation. There are some pictures of brain deformation which are not motivated by mechanics. What I was told is that they typically get people from car accidents who are hit here, and for example, this part of the brain is responsible. I'm not an anatomist, but for example, for the right leg, and the right leg is working right, but some other part or organ of the body is not working right. So they said, what is the cause-effect relationship like as a result of elastodynamics, viscoelastodynamics, et cetera, all of it? Can you do that? And well, I said, well, I work in mechanics of materials, transient waves, and so on, so let's see what we can do. I will talk about the model setup, the transient wave patterns following the impact, all of it based on an MRI. Founded the 3D finite element model of human head, and then I will look critically at foundations of computational mechanics and continuum mechanics from the standpoint of recognizing that the human body is really a stochastic system, spatially random, and on top of it is fractal. So this will be a small excursion into the extension of continuum mechanics, classical type. So here's the MRI typical image, a cut, horizontal cut, and all of you know what's going on here. Actually, the information we get is 256 levels of grayscale of, say, diffusion tensor. Since we don't have rheological data, which is so precise at 256 levels, we quantize the state space, and we recognize some voxels to model skull or to fall into skull, some voxels to fall into CSF, gray matter, white matter, even sculpt eventually. We don't deal with fluid mechanics per se because we're interested in transient wave type phenomena, so there's no point dealing with slow fluid flow, just different time scale. Still, there's a challenge of grasping properly solid mechanics and fluid mechanics in a computational model. So whoever works with in the area of finite elements knows that there are some challenges there for modelers. We then apply a few words about geometry, the way Siemens technology, Siemens machine, which we're using at Illinois, works. It provides those type of voxels, not exactly cubic shaped, almost cubic shaped. There's image segmentation, voxel intensity values, like I said, element tissue types, so there's quantization of the state space 256 into basically just five brackets, coarsely speaking. There's a big issue, the interface of image analysis and micromechanics and microphysics, how to translate a diffusion tensor into, say, fourth rank elasticity tensor, if we agree that material is linear elastic, into fourth rank, say, linear viscoelastic tensor, something like that. So, of course, the mapping will not be one-to-one. One cannot go one-to-one from a second-rank diffusion tensor to a fourth-rank elasticity tensor, and so on. Patient-specific. We have jagged boundaries on the finite element mesh, which would lead to numerical artifacts. We remove them via mesh smoothing technique, which is shown here. So here's a brain separated virtually from the external body. And so there would be those artifacts. We then have a smoothing program which smoothes it out, so we don't have those artificial, say, wavelets propagating from edges. The fact is that the brain is more convoluted on smaller scales, something that will come in later when I turn to fractal aspects of brain surface. So on that scale, the scale of 1 millimeter, this is what it looks like. It seems like it's smooth, but in fact it has smaller gyri and sulci. I'm stuck with 1.3 cubic millimeter voxel resolution. And then we apply properties which we find typically in literature, in biomechanics of brain tissues. So here are some typical data. And same type of thing for gray and white matter, this type of a viscoelastic equation. And then we have a model in 3D to which we can apply whatever loading we want in principle, just keeping in mind that the loading we will apply is good for the first passage of the wave, before the wave hits the neck and would bounce off from the neck back up or something like that. So it's good as far as that is concerned. At the same time, we know that the strongest impact, highest pressure, the highest stresses take place in the first passage of the wave. Upon reflection, some energy is already lost. One just has to be honest about the fact that one cannot deal properly with reflections from the lower part of the brain up, because we don't have this information. We don't have information about what goes on below the neck, the spine, and so on. It's impossible to image the whole person, right, in the MRI tunnel with high precision and so on. So what we do next is we run the model on classical data due to Nahum et al., who did impact tests on cadavers. They were roughly like a strong hammer impact up front on cadavers that had their head sealed here to some extent, fixed. It's not very clear whether they were really fixed on support or loose kind of here. So this is why then we work with two models that I will discuss again, free and fixed boundary conditions. So he measured the impact here. I mean, he knew the actual impact. And this is the coup and counter-coup impact along the line. All right. Experiment is here, is the black kind of broken line. Experiment is here. What we get from simulation, from computer simulation of the entire finite element model is assuming either free boundary condition, the head is separated from the whole body, or fixed boundary condition as if the head was fixed just like a cantilever beam is fixed at the wall. And by variational principle, axiomal principles of mechanics, I know that these are two extreme cases, two bounding cases, which bound the reality, right? One is the least constraining, the other one is most constraining. So in fact, our results turn out to be to have correct character, qualitatively pretty good. One can argue that even quantitatively they are quite good. And what we also get out of this, of course, out of the simulation, is the wave patterns, which I will show in a second. Before I go to wave patterns, I will point out that the pressure wave, which propagates through the brain tissue, is very fast, about 1.5 kilometers per second. On the other hand, the shear wave, just because the shear moduli are so low, is very slow, 2-3 orders of magnitude slower. So this leads to an interesting observation in a second. Here's what we have as far as pressure wave is concerned, pressure distribution. We're looking at the sagittal plane, the nose is here, eyes, and so on, right? The impact is here, the forehead. And we see planar type. It's not really planar, it's distorted surface that passes through the brain. And this happens very fast, about 1.5 kilometers per second. However, if you run the simulation longer, or if I forget to run it, I stop and I think this is the whole thing, the whole story. No, the story is more interesting because there's also a shear wave which takes place. And I will show the shear wave simulations for two cases, for those two assumptions. One is free boundary condition, another one is fixed boundary condition. Okay. So it should load from... Okay. What we see is, so shear wave in the sense of von Mises stress and strain. This is the measure that we have from computer simulation. Nice graphics. We see a wave which is focusing or imploding towards the center of the brain, is sweeping the entire brain. However, the wave itself is shear in nature. It is this type of thing, as anybody who knows solid continuum mechanics knows. The wave of this type will also show up here. In fact, it will be more pronounced. Because it's a fixed boundary condition, the body has less freedom, cannot respond by moving back, therefore the stress is higher, and we clearly see something like a spherically converging, imploding wave. Okay. And so on the next page, I will show snapshots from those movies. First, for the situation of free boundary condition at the neck. So here's the sagittal plane, and here's the beginning, and the time goes on, and I see this wave going into the center, right, sweeping the whole thing. And it's more pronounced in the case of fixed boundary condition. Because of spherical type geometry of the human head, we're looking at the geometric amplification of the wave. If the head were exactly spherical, there would be a tendency to even form a singularity in the middle, which would be horrendous. So nature has excluded this possibility. Still, there is a tendency to blow up because you're sending the energy towards the center. Implosion of the wave. In fact, it's actually difficult to realize in the lab on twin systems to have a wave which is like the inverse of Hankel function that goes to the center. It's easy to make to have an explosion. It's difficult to have an implosion in the lab that focuses back to the center. But luckily, because the tissue is viscoelastic, this wave is dampened. So this is just an observation what's going on. It's my impression that this wave was never noticed before in other studies, simply because either people worked with fluid models of brain, like you pointed out, it doesn't make sense to think of the brain as a fluid, because if you were to put it on the table, it would just become a blob that would tense to a very wide area. And the second thing, I think, is because people just didn't run simulations long enough. They just stopped the simulation after the pressure wave, because you think impact generates a pressure wave. Pressure wave goes through, okay, I'm done, I got my simulation. No, but much later on, I mean, it takes computer time. It takes a lot of integration over 1 million finite elements that I have here. You have to wait for the slow shear wave to go and converge toward the center, sweeping the entire brain. We actually did that. A pure spherical model of a spherical head, spherical brain without neck. Because we're mechanics people. Why not? And we get a pattern which is not exactly spherical. Why? Because the impact is outside it, concentrated somewhere. But this confirms that there's this type of thing. I just wanted to be 100% sure that we don't have some artifacts of the computer model. All right, and next there's the issue, what about other impacts? What about impacts which are not this way, but say this way, like in boxing, a hook, or say impact from the top, all kinds of sports accident type of impacts. This is not good for shocks from explosions, from bomb explosions and so on. Why? Because I don't have finite elements here which are capable of grasping a shock wave. A shock wave is much thinner than a finite element, finite elements about 1 millimeter size, a shock wave from explosion is on the order of nanometers, micrometers. Nobody knows 100% exactly, but I would have to have better shape functions in the model to grasp those waves propagating through all the elements. I don't have such sophisticated shape functions there. It's the next step. However, there's the issue here which pertains to those side impacts to the head, right? So again, two cases, free boundary condition are fixed, and there's a side impact, now it's a horizontal cut, and we see, first of all, there's a pressure wave, which I didn't show, because it was kind of obvious, and then there's a spherical wave, which is focusing more in the on this side of the head where you get hit, all right? And there's the same type of thing, but more pronounced, and without this rigid body motion, because the body is fixed at the neck, here in this simulation. Okay, so whatever impact we do, I'm not showing impact, say, from the top or this impact, now we're doing all kinds of impacts, and we always get those spherically imploding shear waves, which sweep the entire brain, which, as I see it, also explains why each and every person has a somewhat different response, because each and every person has a different shape of the skull, different, even identical twins have differences in the brain structure and so on, so it's not all repeatable from person to person, all right? So on one hand, we have this model. We're doing some validation studies. I will talk in a second. We found this slow spherical conversion wave. I already said that they don't exist in fluid type models of brain. We're doing validation in MRI tunnel. We built a box, a non-metallic box, of course, which fits exactly into Siemens. We have a device here which allows the head to drop, so the head is fixed in a box, and the head drops roughly two centimeters, hits the table, and breaks the fiber optic signal, sets off the MRI, and we get an image. Now, then we lift the head again in the whole box. The head is fixed to the device by a Velcro here, quite tight, so it's repeatable. The point is that with MRI machine, you cannot take a sequence of images every 1/20th of a second. You have to repeat the experiment and take another image a bit later, say 1/20th of a second. Lift the head, repeat the experiment, nominal identical experiment, run the experiment again, and take the image again 1/20th of a second later, or 1/150th, whatever resolution in time. Assuming all the experiments are nominal identical, you splice the images, you have a movie of events. So this is what happens here from 2 millimeter, 2 centimeter impacts on the table, which are very, very mild traumatic brain injuries, not really traumatic. We subject ourselves to those things, providing we don't experience claustrophobia, or we pay students $20 an hour, and they go in there, and we do this type of thing. Yeah, first time I went in, I thought, well, I would be fine because I grew up in communism, so you know I could handle claustrophobia very well. But actually, no. After 50 seconds, I pressed a button. So actually, it takes some training to get used to the constrained area of MRI. Tunnel. So I'm laughing at myself here. The interesting thing is that those images here, this type of cut of the head, show clearly displacement. So images were tagged just before, polarized, right? Just before the drop, and this tagging resides in the tissue for about 2 seconds, which is just long enough for us to see what happens after the impact. And what happens is the tagging goes fades away, but because of tagging, we see the displacement of the tissue. And sure enough, we see displacement on the order of 2 millimeters. Now we're taking exactly the same brain of someone from our group, right? Put it in a computer model, run the computer model, get displacement sure enough on the order, again, of 2 millimeters. I'm now at the stage of getting cross-correlation of experiment with MRI-controlled impact. The MRI controlled impact, movies with computer simulation. The moment I saw that the brain here is sloshing by 2 millimeters from 2 centimeter impact, I really got worried what happens to soccer type impacts when you hit a soccer ball. And it's so fashionable for soccer players to do soccer heading and to be bold, I don't know. And you have those very high quality photographs where a soccer ball clearly is deforming in a concave fashion against the skull. So here's a guy jumping up, right? So he's heading a soccer ball, and here you see this. And clearly, since the skull is not deforming, right? Basically a rigid body, the soccer, which is so stiff, is deforming in a concave fashion. It's clearly visible on photographs. So the moment I saw that, I told my kids who are in soccer clubs, no heading soccer. I'm getting into serious arguments with soccer coaches in the Champaign area right now. Why? The question is, what happens to your brain when on one side of the skull, the soccer ball, which is so stiff, is deforming in a concave fashion? What's really happening to your brain? Maybe it's really sloshing. Maybe there's some cavitation going on, some tearing of tissue, right? The next level that we want to go to is to equip a local football team, American football, with helmets that have 8 accelerometers. The kids will be running around, willing subjects, and sooner or later there will be some accidents. All of them will be imaged before the season, so we'll have healthy brains. Then there's an impact, there's some concussion, assuming the kid will admit he has a concussion, because some of them just tend to hide it, right? They want to be macho and be on the team and so on. And then we get the guy, put him in the tunnel, image the brain, we see the damage. I'm taking the original image of the brain before the season, running in the computer model. From 8 accelerometers, I know the impact vector. I can infer the impact vector that was present during the impact. I will run the simulation. I will have higher level validation, really traumatic brain injury. All right. Here's a time sequence of this red line as a result of this 2 centimeter down drop. Okay, we clearly see something on the order of 2 millimeters. Someone might even argue there's 3 millimeters drop there. So brain is really is deforming quite a bit. From such a small drop, and I mean, you're on the table, first time that happens, you're a bit apprehensive, but then you get used to it. It's bang, bang, and it's not a big deal. But everything was done smearing out the brain tissue on a 1 millimeter length scale. So here's some area of, say, 2x3 voxels. In fact, I see the voxels here, and now what I did, I smeared out properties, say, of this voxel completely by homogeneous continuum. So I have invoked by force representative volume element idea, knowing actually that this is not honest. What's a representative volume element? We have some microstructure. You can think of polycrystalline structure, you can think of biological tissue, you can think of anything you want. The fact is that each and every material has some microstructure, and we're smearing it out, and then we come up with something like, say a linear elasticity model, or linear fluid mechanics, or nonlinear, or something. And so this is the macro scale. And we tell students this is the dV element, or dx, dy, dz element, over which we do calculus. We then apply calculus on this level, knowing full well that there's some microstructure. But the catch is that if I do the smearing out on a scale which is not large enough, I will have variability from place to place in the material. I go over here, I will have different properties as I try to represent here by grayscale. What really I'm doing here, I'm smoothing the microstructure on a length scale, as a result of which I get an inhomogeneous continuum, really one realization of a continuum random field. If I smear out on scale large enough, I will really get a homogeneous continuum. This is akin to taking a sheet of paper, and a good example is either a regular sheet of paper on which we write, the white one, or a hygienic tissue, and we see the grayscale. And clearly, as I'm here, I see the grayscale against light. As I pull it away from my eyes, depending on the eyesight, right? I'm a few meters away, I see idealized continuum, white continuum, right? At 10 meters away from my eyes, I'm not able to see, to make out the flux structure which is roughly 1 centimeter characteristic length. So this is what our eye is doing. Our eye is smearing out, is introducing a scalar continuum. The challenge we have is, suppose I even measure the scalar, the scalar properties of the opacity of the medium, I still have to go to tensor-type properties of rheological type of the material. So the entire field of continuum mechanics is based on separation of scales, namely that there is some scale of some scale L, which is typically classical texts say much larger than the grain size, but it turns out it doesn't have to be much larger. I will discuss it in a second. It definitely has to be much smaller than L macro, because this is where, say, where partial differential equation holds, right? And on top of it, I'm focusing on non-fractal here. On top of it, everything is based on the Lebesgue measure that I'm applying here in the material. If material is fractal, even this breaks down. So then we have to modify the continuum model itself. So here's a paradigm for the scaling. Suppose I'm looking at the polycrystal, but for the sake of argument, I might say think of whatever material you want, granule material or something like that. Each and every grain is different or oriented differently, and this is the disorder in the material. I'm looking at the scale 8 cube, okay, and I homogenize. I have two ways of doing it properly. One is using affine boundary conditions, or Dirichlet, or uniform kinematic boundary conditions here, namely applying mean strain, and the other one is applying mean stress. If I do that, I get a stiff response here, with a shear modulus, in function of mesoscale delta, so 8, so on some scale 8, I have a discrepancy, or I control sigma average. If I go to scale large enough, I actually get a unique response, but I have to go to infinite scale unless the medium has a finite scale periodicity. If the medium doesn't have a finite scale periodicity, I really mathematically have to go to infinite scale, assuming the medium itself has spatial homogeneity and ergodicity. All right, so this is actually calculated here. The scale, the ordinate scale is magnified just for the sake of showing the differences for a polycrystal made of just randomly oriented crystals of the same type. The upper line is void bound, the lower line is Royce bound, and here are the bounds that I pursue, the bounds which are from Dirichlet and Neumann bound condition, or from, using language of mechanics, from displacement controlled and traction controlled boundary condition. And so now people ask me, Martin, what's the size of representative volume element that you recommend? Do you recommend 8, or do you recommend 16, or do you recommend I go to 50? And I say, the choice is yours. The beauty is in the eye of the beholder. If you're willing to live with 5% error in your estimate of rheological properties, in this case, effective shear modulus, it's up to you. Someone else might desire 1% error. If you desire 0% error, exact overlap of those two things, of those two estimates, you have to go to infinite scale, all right, mathematically speaking. But for engineering purposes, you might be good enough on scale 50 by 50 by 50, for example. Where does that concept come from, namely the concept of uniform Dirichlet and uniform Neumann boundary conditions? It comes from the Hill condition, or the Hill-Mandel condition, Hill in England, Mandel in France, independently, a couple of years later. As far as I know, completely independently. So we're looking here at the scalar product of stress with strain, volume averaged. It's required to be equal to scalar product of volume averaged stress with strain volume averaged. Where does that come from? It comes from the idea of strain energy, namely, I have sigma dotted with epsilon, sigma dotted with epsilon. I put one half here, I put one half here. A theoretician would say, I work with energies. For me, energy is very important, the volume average. An experimentalist says, no, I don't care about that. I do things in the lab. I either control stress or I control strain. I apply this or that. So this is really a handshake, the Hill condition, between a theoretician and an experimentalist. I can drop one half because it's trivial, and I have the equality. In a statistical sense, it's equivalent to a statement of zero correlation between stress and strain field. I can show it in discussion later. So here is a matter of a few lines using Gringall's theorem several times, assuming absence of inertia forces and such. And this spits out, so this is a matter of proving, not a big deal. And then this spits out three possibilities. The way to make this zero is to either make this term zero or this term zero, or both of them zero in a certain way. So this is a mixed orthogonal boundary condition. And the nice properties, like I already showed on previous graph, is that this gives a stiffer bound on response, softer bound. But as you go to very fine microstructure, I mean very large scale relative to grain size, in the limit, when the grain becomes infinitesimal relative to the macro scale, or the scale of representative volume element, they provide exactly the same result. Now, when we draw a deforming continuum to students, we're always drawing things. So this is why we're drawing a kinematic picture. We're always drawing this type of thing, because we cannot draw the second one. We're saying, just like Alan showed in his lecture, that this goes, say, into this, right? Or it, I don't know, dilatation or something like that. It's very difficult to draw tractions. But we can think of responsive material in terms of tractions, right? Because I have a duality of the kinematic picture with the force picture in mechanics, always. These boundary conditions, even if you have $1 million budget or 10 million, you cannot really realize in the lab, only on a computer. This one, same story, I cannot control traction at each and every point. What we typically have in the lab is mixed boundary condition, but a bad mixed boundary condition. Well, what we have in the lab, we put a specimen, okay, between the grips. So what? So I'm controlling displacement here, I'm controlling traction, zero traction here, zero traction here. This is not mixed orthogonal boundary condition. This condition corresponds very much to what one does in rubber elasticity tests, where you control zero shear traction, for example, and displacement normal. Okay, and same type of thing in paper experiments. Okay, so actually this type of idea can be carried over to, say, flow in random porous media, where we have a purely phenomenological concept, Darcy law, pure phenomenology. We know this equation makes no sense for flow without any skeleton. We know we have this equation correct, the special case of Navier-Stokes equation, in fluid itself. So we have rigid skeleton, we have some flow field, but investigation of this problem really leads to two types of boundary conditions here. Okay, I'm looking at this, I'm looking at pressure gradient with velocity, and this is the Hill condition corresponding to Darcy law problem, this one here, and so I have my boundary conditions. I can do my Guericke and Neumann boundary value problems, which then give me estimates of the represent volume size or scaling to represent volume element, all right? And this is shown here using the pressure fields. So here I control pressure, here I control velocity gradient, I show the variability in pressure, all right? The reason that we did it is that we wanted to have an estimate of the size, I mean, how many grains do I have on which Darcy law is valid? It's not valid on the size of a single channel, it's not valid on the size scale of two channels, how about five, how about 10? So this is where the question came from. On what scale can I honestly homogenize material, say with many little channels or some, you know what I mean, maze type of thing where fluid flows in a Stokes fashion, and the result is consistent with our intuition in the sense that the denser the material, meaning the smaller the channels relative to the solid mass, the faster the scaling. The looser the material, I mean the bigger the channels, the larger the volume fraction of fluid, the bigger scales you have to go to homogenize the material. So this is what we're using right now to do estimates of RVE size for poroelasticity. It can also be done for finite elasticity, and luckily there's one pair of conjugate variables in finite elasticity, only one pair which works, which satisfies Hill condition in a nice way, this first Peierlein-Kirchhoff tensor and deformation gradient. And if you take another pair, it will not work. So we can do these boundary conditions. Okay, I showed them on purpose explicitly here. We then have to work not with shear modulus, bulk modulus, right? We do finite elasticity. We work with functionals. One functional parameterized by displacement field, another functional parameterized by strain measure, parameterized by the stress field. So we found the such functionals in literature. We applied it here, and we sure enough, we have here a functional like potential energy, and this like complementary energy. And so what I will show next is results for a particular situation, an Ogden-type matrix with Neo-Hookian inclusions, all right? Some particular values, say contrast 10 and so on. And here's what happens. Here's Ogden-type matrix with Neo-Hookian inclusions. And as I'm going with displacement control boundary conditions, I go from above this way. If I go with traction control boundary conditions, I go from below that way. And roughly on the scale of 16, I get two lines which almost overlap in the middle. But one line corresponds to controlling displacements, another one is controlling tractions. Okay. And of course, it's easy to draw a displacement picture, but very difficult to draw a traction picture for a finite elastic material where traction is uniform in sense of first Peale Kirchhoff tensor and so on. Just to give you an idea that this is the dual formulation which one can always set up. All right. And there's also like things like Taylor bound or void bound and Royce bound. And one can do the same type of thing for plasticity. One can ask questions about scaling, say, in elastoplasticity and so on. Was the size. So we did a lot of these studies, elastic versus inelastic microstructure. And basically, elastic scales faster, inelastic slower. The moment you put anything like plasticity or something, we only have some qualitative formulas, results for viscoelasticity. No computations were done at all. It's faster to get RV in 3D than in 2D, and the way we understand it is that the Green's function in 3D for elasticity has a different kernel, faster kernel, than a Green's function in 2D elasticity. So in 3D, kind of material has less freedom, so it has to homogenize faster, speaking phenomenologically. Okay, the things depend on many things, mismatching properties. I mean, looking at microstructure, suppose I have a picture, black and white composite picture. I cannot say anything about this scaling to RV because I don't know what's the mismatch between black and white. If black and white differ just by 5%, it would be very fast. If black and white differ by factor 500, it will be very slow. It will take a long way to homogenize to get the RV size. So geometry alone is misleading. I mean, just this is guidance alone. Microscale geometries, of course, the microstructure itself, disks versus ellipses, spatial clustering, hardly anybody looked at that. We have specific results for scaling to RV in linear elastic microstructures, a lot of that. And then there's a number of problems. One of them is brain mechanics, I would say, or all over the whole biomechanical field, where we don't have separation of scales. Because perhaps by the time you homogenize the particular microstructure, you already hit the bone, for example, right? So I cannot go to very big scale. So I want to have a continuum which has spatial variability inside. And so we need to work with random fields. Why random? Because it's really patient-specific. So from each to every other, from person to person, is variable. I have the mean, and perhaps I have second moments, third moments. I describe it by random fields. So then this is an invitation to stochastic boundary value problems using, for example, stochastic finite elements. Given the fact that on mesoscales, where I'm below the RVE size, I have no unique description. I either have a description of effective response using Dirichlet boundary value problem or Neumann boundary value problem. I don't have a unique description of the material. So there's no unique continuum random field description. Really, what I recommend is working with two bounds. Otherwise, I don't really know where I am inside here. There's a number of studies which assume, let's assume continuum random field something. Or let's take like wave equation and randomize the refraction index or something like that. But actually, if you go through all the steps of deriving the wave equation, the moment you introduce variable elasticity field, and on top of it, perhaps variable density field, then you have extra terms coming out. from the equation, right? So this whole approach, such approaches are dishonest. Those considerations lead me to conclude that there's no smooth localized isotropic continuum. If I have an isotropic continuum, it responds same way in each direction. But if I have a gradient in properties, definitely responds this way is different than the response that way. And there's also a contradiction from correlation theory point of view. So I have a review of those issues in a recent book. But now, there's another complication on top of everything, namely the fact that the brain has a fractal geometry. Okay, brain surface itself, the neural system itself, arteries, veins, and so on, pulmonary system. Here's cross-section, the classical, right? And this is what I referred to earlier, that we have this type of thing and then those, but even smaller scale, and people calculated fractal dimensions of human brain surfaces. In fact, it came out to be about 2.73, 2.79. Right, this roughly speaking, in this range, the surface of the brain, where the highest level of thinking takes place, contains a large number of folds. Because of this, a human, who is the most intellectually advanced animal, I don't know if I want to use this word, has the most folded surface of the brain as well. All right, so one can write science fiction about beings that have higher fractal dimension, and the moment you go to whales and dolphins, it sinks to about 2.5, 2.4, and so on, and simpler animals than 2. So I'm not criticizing people who do experiments in rats, but the fact is that the brain surface of a rat is much less folded, has a much, much lower, basically, fractal dimension 2. It's just surface. It's not partially plane filling. Okay, and so a few words about fractals. Just to explain basic ideas, what's going on. I suppose this is a famous paper. There's a famous paper by Mandelbrot from the 1960s where he was developing his ideas. He asked the question, what's the length of the coast of Britain? And so suppose you use the yardstick of this size, okay, coarse measurement, and you sum up, you get the perimeter. But you suppose you use a finer yardstick, and you get more of it. Suppose you use a finer yardstick, this guy here. And I'm going around and I get a longer perimeter, yeah? So the funny thing is that if we decrease, as we decrease the yardstick, we don't seem to converge anywhere. We seem to be getting new results all the time, which is completely at odds with what's going on in Euclidean geometry, where suppose I want to do calculate perimeter of a circle, I go with this yardstick, all right? I get something, then I refine my measurement, right? I go with a shorter one, and pretty soon I converge, yeah? I converge, we know, to number pi. There's an interesting story that in the mid-19th century, there was an idea in the state legislature of Indiana to patent an approximation of number pi, namely to make it 3, and then to sell this idea. But luckily, a professor of mathematics from Purdue University was visiting the state legislature in Indianapolis and told them, stop this because you will make fools of yourself. So we know what happens with the circle. But with coast of Britain, it goes on like that, and you go to smaller and smaller. And of course, one might say, well, really all I need is to do length of coast of Britain on a human scale. But suppose you're building ports, harbors and so on, you're interested in a different scale. So the perimeter, the length of the coast, depends on your application, right? And so this leads to a so-called coastline paradox, which is not a paradox anymore the moment you recognize that the perimeter depends on the yardstick. So there's this, from Wikipedia, they copied a table from the CIA of coastlines of various countries, and Canada is number one, of course, because of its archipelago, Indonesia, Greenland, and so on. But the thing they point out is that CIA World Factbook figures were measured are not stated, nor is it known, I mean, scales at which the coastlines were measured are not stated, whether the figures are all using the same scale. So, the whole table is questionable. I'm not criticizing the CIA, but the whole table is questionable as far as, you know, what are we comparing? suppose you compare the coastline of Philippines with coastline of Japan, were they measured, say, from satellite photographs using the same yardstick or different yardstick done by someone else? Of course, at some point, when we do measurements, we have to stop. I mean, as we refine and refine the yardstick, at some point you will say, well, stop, because I'm hitting the atomic scale, molecular level, and it doesn't make sense to go below 1 nanometer, right? If I go with nanometer, I will get millions of kilometers, right? And another level, the level of the country itself, you also have to stop. So these are the lower and upper cutoffs of a fractal. So fractal is a good model only for some range of scales between the upper and lower cutoffs. I'll come to cutoffs in a second. Here's what mathematics can do for you to simulate mountains. So this is done with Brownian sheets, which are generalization of Brownian processes on R2. And if one were to put one more process here, modeling glacier, one would have a picture that would be hardly distinguishable. This computer simulation, that's reality. All right. So here's porous rock, which I photographed on the coast of Cancun on a scale of 1 millimeter, scale of 0.1 meter. And so one can go finer, and one has to also stop on the scale of, say, the coast of Cancun, which is like 100 kilometers roughly or something. And so there's the concept of a prefractal here, which exactly pertains, it's the same thing as saying physical fractal. Fractal which has upper cutoff and a lower cutoff. And I have to keep that in mind when I'm modeling brain, because I have some upper cutoff and lower cutoff. What I develop will only hold between some two limits. What I will not talk about is why do we have morphogenesis, which leads to fractal shapes. And there's various models in literature depending on the problems, physical problems. So this is another area where people are working. What happens? I mean, why do we observe fractal shapes in nature and so on? So I talked about fractal geometry, and there's even books like Fractals Everywhere and so on, which is beautiful pictures modeling, you know, just about anything you want in nature. And then we have a field of continuum mechanics, which assumes smooth fields, and which works pretty well, but we have to make a connection. So this is my motivation here. We're really at the baby stage here. What goes on, I'm following here ideas of Tarasov, a Russian mathematical physicist, whose papers I found a few years ago. And so let's say I have mass which scales like r to the power d. D is less than 3. If d is equal to 3, we have classical things. The idea is as follows. I'm writing the equivalence of mass of a fractal. Fractal here is w. W is embedded in the Euclidean space, three-dimensional space. And I'm writing that this is equal to integral of this in the Euclidean space itself. So dv sub 3 is your classical dv. This classical dv, which we're using everywhere. Dv sub d is the measure of the fractal itself, the fractal object, which is poorer than the Euclidean object. So this is the idea of changing the integrals. Going from integration over a space which is lower dimensionality, because fractal is, for example, 2.7 dimensional. And I mean, but it's embedded in a three-dimensional space. Therefore, I have an integral here over three-dimensional. This is classical dv3. So the whole trick, you will say, everything is fine, providing I know what is c3. Right? Here I have dv3, the Lebesgue measure, but I have to correct it by a Ries measure type of thing. And his Ries measure was a Riemann-Liouville type of thing. It's very similar to fractional derivatives of Riemann-Liouville type. We came in, and I mean, I give full credit always to Tarasov, and I'm in touch with him, but I realized that this is not general enough, because real materials have fractal dimensions which are different, for example, in X than in Y than in Z. I might have something which is, say, contour-like in X and Sierpinski carpet type in YZ plane. So I have to have three dimensions, and I can introduce a product law formulation here. X1 to alpha 1, x2 to alpha 2, x3 to alpha 3, alpha 1 plus alpha 2 plus alpha 3 add up to d. D is the total one. This is a special case of that one, right? So this is more general. And so then I introduced a product measure instead of the Lebesgue measure, classical Lebesgue measure on which just about all of, almost everything, all continuum mechanics hinges. We have to go away from Lebesgue measure. And we have this rho here. And then the question is, well, how to really develop those d mu, d mu 1, d mu 2, d mu 3. If I know at least one of them how to do it, then I'm on a home run. And luckily, we came across papers by a mathematician, Jumarie, in Montreal, written just a few years ago, who's interested in time processes, fractal in space, fractal in time, time processes. There's no space. He's not really interested in space. I'm in touch with him, but he doesn't have much interest in space phenomena. So this provides this expression for C1 scaling in x coordinate. It has very nice properties, which I will show in a second. The point is that if I have C1, I can compose a surface coefficient. Why? Because I need a Cartesian type of cube, parallel pipe, to do continuum mechanics. And I can formulate a volume coefficient, which is a product. So I'm relying on those on this product thing in three dimensions. And now I'm going, I'm doing an integral over, over a fractal surface with respect to ds sub d. I have a d. Now, there's two fractal dimensions. One of them pertains to surface. Another one, capital D, pertains to mass distribution in space. So if I have a body, it's characterized by, once again, here supposes this fractal and so on. D is a spatial distribution, and lowercase d, this describes the fractal dimension of the surface. There's two fractal dimensions, independent. And this one doesn't have to be this plus one. It's independent. All right. So this idea of changing integrals is based on this concept from quantum mechanics. Then we can write things like Green Gauss theorems, and they work through, and Reynolds theorem generalized to fractal media, they work through. We found the fractal gradient operator, fractal derivative, there's a correction. But on the other hand, time derivative is not corrected. Okay. Now here are three nice properties which this formulation has. First of all, I have back and forth, I have inverse of differentiation with integration. The next one is a nice property of the product, which does not exist with Riemann-Liouville-based type of thing. And the third one, one might laugh, but some fractional derivatives are so crazy, like, for example, Riemann-Liouville, that they will not give a zero when you differentiate a constant. They are good for some applications, but not definitely I don't want this in continuum mechanics. So I have my gradient operator, fractal gradient operator, which now works nicely, gives me zero. And I can generalize Reynolds theorem and so on from now on. From this stage on, I can go and start generalizing continuum mechanics, knowing full well that all I'm doing is in the bracket between lowercase l and capital L. This is where I have my prefractal, right? When I'm below, say, 10 nanometers, I have classical, for example, continuum mechanics. When I'm above, for example, 1 meter, again, classical continuum mechanics. So you can think of, say, porous structure as an Apollonian packing, right, where you take big circles, then you plug smaller circles in between, smaller. It's a classical fractal. One can do the same type of thing with balls. And below this level, I have a non-fractal medium. Above this level, I have a homogenized continuum. Yeah, so basically, I come here, I skip four slides if there's questions, and I just end up with conclusions here, right? So, all the formulas collapse back to classical continuum mechanics in a situation where you have a non-fractal or when those fractal dimensions, d and capital D, are integers. So it's consistent. So I can apply it to whatever problems in case the actual problem is non-fractal. I get it back. It has various properties here which we derive. But all of it was really done so far for porous type media where I have solid phase with kind of vacuum in the interstitial channels, and the challenge now is to do it for multiphase materials. Okay, and then also there's challenges with introducing local features like dura membranes and so on in the computational modeling in 3D, which is difficult because MRI does not see it properly. Thank you very much.